Well, I get pig-headed and I drink too much. I'm out of state and I'm out of touch. Got a reckless heart and a beggar's knee. I could write a book,
he could write a book
about me. Well, I don't say much, but I love to talk. Got a funny way and a funny walk. Got a point of view that's hard to see. I could write a book,
he could write a book
about me. It's a hard story with soft cover. Every heart is double-spaced. Poor bookmark, there's a bottle, so I don't lose my place.
You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM-LP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Gary Lee Miller, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors, and other people inside the world of books. In 1951, when Elizabeth Marshall Thomas was 18, her father made a decision that would change her life forever. He took his family to live in Africa's Kalahari Desert, one of the remotest places on Earth. For Elizabeth Thomas, this was the start of a lifetime of adventure, one recounted with clarity, insight, and humor in her fantastic new memoir, Dreaming of Lions, out recently on Chelsea Green Publishing. In the book, Marshall recounts exploring the mountains of New Hampshire as a child, living among the Kalahari Bushmen as a young woman, keeping her family safe in a civil war in Nigeria, and surviving an unpleasant encounter with a Ugandan military officer named Idi Amin. A keen observer of the natural world, Thomas brings us along as she meets a leopard in the bush at midnight, follows dogs around Cambridge, Massachusetts to write about their secret lives, and waits patiently for an elusive cougar to make an appearance in her own backyard. And she shares stories of her remarkable family, one that could easily be the subject of a book of its own. Elizabeth Marshall Thomas's career as a writer includes works of both fiction and nonfiction. Her subjects range from the Kalahari Bushmen to cats, dogs, and deer, and the imagined lives of prehistoric hunter-gatherers in Siberia thousands of years ago. At 85, Thomas's life of adventure isn't over yet. As I interviewed her recently, she was getting ready to travel to Tanzania to witness the wildebeest migration on the Serengeti Plain with her friend and fellow writer, Cy Montgomery. But first, we talked about Dreaming of Lions. Let's have a listen. Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, welcome to Write the Book.
Thank you.
Great to have you with us here today. I want to just say that I absolutely loved the book.
Thanks.
And I'm not usually so strident, but I'm actually at the point of ordering people to read it. It's just completely remarkable story, and you're such a great writer. I just thoroughly enjoyed every minute.
Well, thank you.
Anyway, I was wondering if you could start our discussion by just reading a little bit from the book to give us a flavor.
Okay. I will, in that case, read about meeting a leopard. I did some field work in northern Uganda, and among people called warfaring pastoralists, people called Dadoth. And here's the passage. One afternoon, I accompanied some of the Dadoth to a dance in a settlement 2 or 3 miles away. But not until after dark did I learn that the people with whom I'd gone were planning to spend the night. This meant I would be going back to camp by myself. This was we were in a very wild country, northern Nigeria, just below the Sudan border, and it was a very wild country with lots of wildlife, lions, leopards, whatever. Okay. I would be going back to camp. This meant that I would be going back to camp by myself. Since I had been counting on my companions to find the way home, I hadn't taken a flashlight, and of course no weapon, but I thought, oh well, and started walking. The moon was low in the west, the night was dark, and I had a long way to travel. I got lost in the heavy bush, but with the help of the constellation Orion, I was trying to go east, hoping to cross a north-south track made earlier by my vehicle. Instead, I crossed a footpath. I stopped and looked around and noticed the outline of a hill against the sky. There were plenty of hills in the area, but the hill I was looking at seemed to resemble the hill where my camp would be, and the path led toward it. Without a better idea of where to go, I started up the path. If it wasn't the right hill, I could always keep going east in search of the vehicle track. Suddenly, just ahead of me, a leopard coughed. This was worrisome. Evidently, I was walking toward him. But since I didn't know where I was, except that I was very near a leopard, I had no idea where else to go. I didn't want to stand still in the dark in case, not hearing footsteps, he might approach me. I also didn't want to turn and walk in another direction, because then he'd be behind me and leopards attack from behind. At least he was trying to tell me where he was. Hoping that I was right about the hill and my camp, I took the only option left to me and kept walking slowly toward him. He coughed again, louder. "What are you doing? I'm a leopard." Well, I certainly knew he was a leopard, but could think of no other plan except to keep going. I believe he became exasperated, because after a moment of what seemed like astonished silence as he listened to my slowly advancing footsteps, he coughed three times, as fast and forcefully as he could. "You're not listening. Now you're too close." But I still didn't know what else to do except keep going. He didn't cough again, so perhaps he decided that his warnings were useless. As I approached the place where he'd been coughing, I got the feeling that he had left. If he hadn't, at least he lay low and let me pass safely. It was the old way. He never would have coughed if he was hunting me, in which case I'd be nothing but the dust of a dried-up leopard scat by now. Surely he coughed so that I wouldn't come up on him, get scared, and take the offensive in close quarters. For all their predatory skills, leopards are cautious. Evidently he wanted some distance between himself and a potential passerby. Old rules govern the old way, and he was keeping one of the rules as it applies to cats. Do not fight and risk injury if you can help it, as injury will decrease your chances for survival. You can warn and threaten, but don't attack unless you must. Animals have all kinds of methods for avoiding unnecessary confrontations. I think of the neighboring cats that vocalized in my parents' basement without actually fighting, the cats I observed when I was five. The leopard's method, it seemed, was to alert me to his presence. When I didn't seem to understand, he took the initiative and left. The hill was Murakori, my camp was on it, and I reached it in a fairly short time. This was not because I ran, but because the camp was near. There is nothing worse than running from a predator unless you're sure you can get to safety before he gets to you. Better to show confidence, as if you feel so strong and confident that the predator is of no concern. If you can't do that, then it's often best to face him and try to make yourself seem bigger by holding your coat or your backpack over your head, for instance, as hikers facing cougars are advised to do. This is why our skin prickles when we're scared. We're raising our hair to seem bigger, although we don't know this consciously. We do as we would have done when our body hair was long and thick, back when we lived in the trees. Back when our raised hair would make us seem much bigger. And I find it quite touching that we humans with our tiny body hairs continue to do this. Obviously, the leopard was the one who had been watching our camp. My body hair rose when I heard his first cough. I was, in a sense, flying. And that's the end.
That's wonderful.
Thank you.
It really is. And it has some very practical advice for anyone who should be confronted by a predator, I might add.
Yeah, it's chancy. I mean, I was lucky, but...
Sure.
You know, if you walk right up to them, you know, they might... Well, but anyway, I was very lucky. And he was a nice leopard, obviously. A reasonable leopard.
Leopard.
Yeah.
You know, again and again as I read this book, I kept thinking, you know, well, this is enough adventure for one lifetime. And then I'd read more and think, well, this is enough. You know, it just seems to me almost impossible that so many incredible, I mean, this story of the leopard is the least of it, and all this could be crammed into a single person's life. I'm wondering if you could start by talking a bit about your young life and the remarkable parents who brought you up, because I think they played a key role in your having such an amazing life.
Well, they did. For one thing, I was born into a household with animals. We had cats and a wonderful dog, Newfoundland dog named Mishka, who was like my nanny, our nanny, my brother and I. She wouldn't let us do things like go into the water or at the beach, stuff like that. She was a very strict dog, but from these animals, it was very clear to me that animals have thoughts and feelings, and I mean, they're like people with different bodies, and very clear, and it was just amazing to me later to find out that at the time, scientific opinion was that they did not. But we were right as kids, and the scientists were wrong. I'll just put it that way. And let's see. My dad, he was a civil engineer, and he loved the wild places for various reasons, and he wanted to go to. He wanted us all to go, when my brother and I were in our teens, wanted us all to go to a place which was essentially a complete wilderness as it was before there were so many people on the earth and so forth. And he looked on the maps of the world for a place that had no map markings on it. And he found three. He found one in Antarctica, one on Tasmania, and one in southwestern part of Africa, which turned out to be the Kalahari Basin. But it was unexplored. It was about 120,000 square miles, which was known as the end of the earth. And so he decided to go there. And he learned that Bushman people lived there, and Bushman turned out to be the ancestor. The Bushman people were the ancestors of all humanity. Their language is thought to be the first language and the basis of all other languages. So he organized an expedition, and we went in there and found Bushmen and lived there for, I was there about 3 years. My parents and my brother were there much longer. And that was a very formative thing. I mean, I've seen everything since then through that lens. So my dad was venturesome, and he was pretty capable too. I mean, we were well equipped. We had no trouble. We had spare axles for the truck and trucks, and plenty of gasoline and plenty of water. There was no surface water in there. You had to know where the water holes were, and since it was quote unquote unexplored, we had no way of knowing. And I'm just going to say something about unexplored. The Bushmen. Later on, an excavation was done of a Bushman encampment, and it was found that it had had continuous occupancy for 35,000 years, more than that. They didn't get to the bottom of the excavation, but in 35,000 years, the culture had changed very little, which makes sense because there are only certain ways you could live as a hunter-gatherer. So the culture was presumed to be the social culture. There's no way to know, but there was certainly no evidence that it was different from when we got there.
And also, at the time you arrived, they had had little to no contact with anyone from the outside, right?
They had no non-Bushmen. That's right, and it was the lack of water. Since there, I mean, 120,000 square miles with no surface water. And if you don't know where the water is, it's very dangerous. It would be very dangerous to go.
Right. You talk a lot about the the Bushmen, and it seems you admire them a great deal.
Oh, yeah.
What made them and makes them different from, or how are they different from the people, you know, at the time that you had been grown up among your whole life?
Well, they weren't, several things. They weren't, they were thought of as different from by people who didn't know them. They were thought to be very dangerous. They were thought to be, you know, they'd never been to school, so they were ignorant. That kind of thing, and the opposite. I mean, the thing that impressed me the most was their knowledge. They knew every plant and insect, animal, whatever. They knew what it was. They knew. They had named almost everything, as far as I know, and they could recognize a beetle's tracks, to say nothing of the tracks of any animal. They could almost tell you what it was thinking when it made the tracks. I mean, they were extremely observant and expert. So that was.
And they had to be. They had to be.
They had to be. Yeah. But they were very different from us. I mean, we know it's a tree, but we don't know what kind of a tree.
Right.
You know, or a bird. But they did.
And kind of socially, how were they different?
Well, again, they were thought to be... okay, the first book I wrote about them was named The Harmless People. And I got a lot of flack from that, from anthropology people, because the idea was that people... There are no harmless people. People are a vicious lot. Well, that's true. But the Bushmen knew that. The title came from their name for themselves. And they valued social stability very strongly. It was their key to survival. In the area I'm speaking of, well, we were involved in an area of about 6,000 square miles. In that area, there were 8 permanent water holes and 7 impermanent ones. And if you and about maybe 20 or 30 people would live at each water hole. If your water hole went dry, then what do? You have to be able to go to another water hole. And you could either go there and fight off the people who were there and, you know, kill them and take the water hole. But that, they have came, obviously, saw that that was not the way to for survival. So they had a very complicated system of, a very widespread system of joining to other people, kinship system, marriage system, a gift partnership system where you exchange gifts with somebody, and then people would walk perhaps 100 miles to exchange a gift with a gift partner. But then these groups were your in-laws, were your relatives, were your the people you were named for, the people who were named for you, this kind of thing. These were all social connecting things. You could go to those people, and they would take you in. And this 35,000 years, that's a long time, and if it works, stick with it. The other thing would be that they were very focused on not making other people jealous. Everybody was equal. Nobody was more important than anybody else. Even if a person was very skilled at something, a hunter perhaps, he didn't make anything of it, of being better than others. He didn't. And decisions were made by consensus. Everybody's voice was as important as everybody else's. There were no headmen, no chiefs. People were equal. This kept down the feelings of jealousy. It isn't that the people didn't have bad feelings. They had them just as much as anybody else. But the idea was to squash them, and with a heavy, heavy protection level of all these cultural factors, they had to do that. And it worked. I mean, 35,000 years is a long time. You know, they'd been there much longer, perhaps 150,000, 200,000, something like that.
If you're just joining us on Write the Book, I'm here with Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, author of Dreaming of Lions, My Life in Wild Places, and that's out on Chelsea Green Books. I wanted to ask you, you mentioned this a little bit in the piece you read earlier about the leopard. You use the term the old way. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, that's my term for the Bushmen lived in the old way, the way, and actually it's only modern human beings who don't live that way. Any animal you see is living in the old way, which is that living from the natural world, in the natural world, with the understanding it, knowing how to live there. And everything lives that way. And I use that. I mean, I think I coined that title for that way of life. And I used it as the title of another book.
Right. You went to Africa the first time with your parents, and then you came back home to Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Yes.
For a while, and there you met the man who would be your husband and your companion for many, many...
60 years.
What was it that made you two such a fast pair?
We were 18, and I chose him because he had a terrific sense of humor and a motorcycle. and he chose me. I won't tell you why he chose me, but it had to do with my appearance.
Okay.
But I mean, that... We were lucky.
That's what those motorcycle guys are all about.
Yeah, but I think a lot of, we were lucky then because it, you know, we fortunately got along very well, and we were married for 60 years.
Right. That first trip to Africa became your first book, correct?
It did.
And then you began to make a career as a writer. You and Steve soon after made a trip to Uganda. Why did you go there?
A publisher. Actually, it was the New Yorker, William Shannon, the New Yorker, had been offered the first book, The Harmless People, but whoever saw it rejected it. But then he asked my agent why she hadn't showed it to him, and she said she had sent it in, but it was whoever read it rejected it. Okay, and he said, well, would I go and write another book? And I said, yeah, I would, and I did. The first one was about hunting and gathering, so I thought the second one would be about another way of living, which would be pastoralists, people who had large herds of cattle or livestock, and considered those people valued cattle and livestock. It was as we value money. I mean, it was the same thing. They were also very knowledgeable about cattle, of course. So I thought, well, I'll do that. So I went there and wrote a book called Warrior Herdsmen, because they were warriors, and met Idi Amin by accident, and in a kind of nasty...
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that. I mean, this trip was markedly different from the previous
one. Oh, yeah.
And you met people who definitely weren't harmless people, including Idi Amin.
That's true, but they were, you know, within the culture, you live by your culture, and
right.
So, and they were wonderful people, just the same. The Dadaath, many, many friends among those people, and I had huge admiration for them. They raided another group like themselves, who in turn raided them for cattle.
And so this had probably been going on for thousands of years. It was the
A long time.
Sure.
Yeah. And I mean, they had a whole different theory of how to survive, and they were doing it. Okay, but the Uganda was then a protectorate, a British protectorate, and the protectorate government wanted to stop the raiding, so they sent some soldiers, quite a good sized group of soldiers. And the leader of the soldiers was Idi Amin. He was a colonel. It was the King's African Rifles. That was the name of the army.
Right.
And Idi Amin was either he was a colonel or he was a lieutenant. He became a colonel. I don't know if he was a colonel when he got there. But anyway, he was in charge. And he led his soldiers down over the escarpment. This was by the escarpment. Down the escarpment into Kenya, where he came upon a village with cattle, and he basically killed most of the people and quite a few of the cattle. But there was no real evidence that these were cattle that had been raided from the Dadoth, so why he did it is unclear. Then he asked, he did an incredibly cruel thing. A little girl was, this was told to me by a Dadoth. The Dadoth, some Dadoth men went down with the soldiers. A little girl was, her mother had been shot, and her little daughter was clinging to her and crying, and Idi Amin took the child and broke her back with a stone by pounding it with a stone. And this was too much for the Dadoth warriors killing people, bragging about it. This was too much for them. They couldn't see doing that at all. But anyway, then he burned the corpse of one of the men in a fire. I don't know why. And then he pulled that corpse and also a few dead cows back up the escarpment and put them in a truck and drove, and they came to my camp. And and Idi Amin wanted, he kind of told me rather than asking me, to put the corpse in my car and drive it down about 50 miles to a government post. Well, that's a dilemma. I mean, what do I do? My kids were with me. They were 4 and 6. And do you take your kids in a car with a corpse for 50 miles, or a burned corpse? Or do you leave them behind with Idi Amin? And so I thought I have to think of something. So I just pretended to be, I just said, I'm sorry, but I don't think my car can make the trip, and I'm not a very good driver, and, you know, I'm just a weak woman, and you know, that sort of thing. And he was angry, but I did not drive the corpse 50 miles with my kids in the car, to make a long story short.
That seems unbelievably frightening to me.
Well, he was a scary guy.
Little did he know you were the woman who would walk by a coughing leopard without...
Well, but in both cases, I didn't have a choice.
Right.
I mean, yeah. I didn't do it for bravery or fun. I did it because there was nothing else I could do.
Right. And later on, you and Steve were with your family in Nigeria. You write about that. And
yeah.
And it was even a worse situation, I think.
Well, the Kalahari was, the whole thing was bliss as far as I'm concerned. Uganda was wonderful except for that moment. But Nigeria was very tough because the civil war began. And there was a military coup while we were there. I mean, we'd been there for a while and things were going pretty well, but this was to write another book. Things were going pretty well, but when the Civil War began, after the coup, the rumor was that the British and the Americans were going to invade in order to restore the former government. And all expatriates were hostages. The borders were closed. No plans, no doubt. There was no leaving or coming into the country, and there was an awful lot of fighting, murders, people setting fires, that kind of thing. It was very scary. So that was and I never did write that book. I just we were there for almost, well over a year.
So you were effectively trapped in the country, and you couldn't.
With my kids, our kids. So.
And how did you explain that to your children? How did you?
I don't know.
Help to make it okay for them. I mean.
Well, it wasn't okay. Yeah. We didn't try to tell them it was okay because that's misinformation. But we lived in a neighborhood where there were other kids, and the kids just more or less played by themselves. I mean, they knew things weren't right, but I don't think they felt a tremendous amount of fear or pressure.
Right.
It did not come to our neighborhood exactly. That would have been very different. Oh, well, stuff happened in our neighborhood, but the actual war wasn't wasn't exactly where we were. The grown-ups didn't know if it was going to come there, but you know, at the time, things were sort of, there was nothing much else you could do.
Right. There's a chapter in the book called Dark, and it talks about after you returned home from Nigeria, apparently that was traumatizing to you, and it.
Yes. The one day my husband and with a friend, a colleague, and our son, they went to the northern region. We were in the western region. They went to the northern region for some stuff they had to do, and our son wanted to go. So they went. Things had quieted down a little.
Mm-hmm.
But I heard, well, then they were going to, there was one road, only one road, up there. And they went up that road, and they would be coming back down that road. And I heard that there was, with the all the violence and the unrest, there was one village or town in which the people were stopping cars, and they would pull people out of the cars and kill them, and they were dropping children down a well, and I just got terrified, and I had no way to warn them. There were the phone lines were off. People had cut down the phone lines, and there were no phone lines, no phones. And my daughter was with me, and I would have gone and tried to find them and warn them, but I couldn't leave my daughter behind, and I couldn't take her with me. So I had to wait, and what happened was that they found out about something on the other side of the northern region, so they went from the southern side. They were on the southern side, and they went to the northern side, and then came back along another road. So they didn't come down that road, but that was 2 days, and I knew I'd have to. They didn't even plan to be back before 2 days, so I knew I'd have to wait 2 days before I knew if they were dead or alive, and I just couldn't stand it. And so I drank some. I poured myself a teacup full of gin and drank it, and that helped some. And I drank two, and that helped some. And from that kind of started me drinking. I mean, I drank socially before that, but that kind of started me drinking, which I continued to in an addictive way. It mounted from there. It didn't stir from there. And so that was. So then I had to do something about that.
Sure.
And I after we went home. We got home, and I was still drinking, but I didn't feel well, of course. So I went to the doctor. I was too young to feel that bad, and I was 30 something. And I went to the doctor, and he asked me how much I drank, and I told him. And he said, why did I drink? And I said, well, because I'm so depressed and I'm so anxious, and I just drink to get rid of the feeling. And he asked if I knew that alcohol caused that feeling. And no, I didn't know that. So that I stopped right then. I didn't drink again after that for many, many years. And then much later, my parents and all their friends, everybody drank cocktails in the evening. I mean, it was just, and for any celebration or any party, there was always alcohol. It was an essential ingredient for social gatherings. Neither of my parents were alcoholic at all, but I became what I certainly feel was alcoholic, but I didn't know about it because I didn't go to AA. I just quit drinking, and I thought, what does it matter if I'm an alcoholic if I don't drink? And I didn't even know about AA. But then the second time I started drinking, I thought, well, I'm a different person now, and I'll just try it. But the next thing I know, I was hooked again. So I went to a rehab place where
sure.
Which is very near where we live, and that was that. I mean, I did stop after that, and I belong to AA, but I don't get to go enough these days. But I'd like to. people in AA are very interesting, wonderful people. I think they're smarter than other people. They know more. They know more stuff. They know more about life. And so if anybody who is listening is alcoholic and wants to quit, I would strongly advise going to AA because it's just very helpful. The other people are very helpful.
I would agree with you. I want you to know that I mentioned earlier that I had been basically ordering people to read your wonderful book, and among the people that I've shared it with are people in a program that I've been working with for 2 years called Writers for Recovery. And we provide free writing workshops for people recovering from all sorts of addictions. I've read pieces of your book in the group, and I actually have in my Burlington group a line of people waiting to borrow the book when I'm done with this interview. So it'll be handed off immediately.
Well, that's very interesting. To me that seems like a wonderful approach.
Yeah, it's been quite fantastic, actually.
And I bet you get some fabulous stuff from the writers.
Unbelievable. You can look at it if you'd like at writersforrecovery.org. There's a blog with all sorts of writing.
Oh, I'd love to. Writers, I'm taking a note.
I mean, we have such a huge problem with addiction in our society now. As someone who has been through the recovery process, what do you think it is that people don't know about addiction but should know? Is there any wisdom you have in that regard?
Well, the only thing I know of is that if people think it's a moral failure or a character flaw, that's a mistake. Because if they knew anything about the people in these programs, they'd see that, you know, yes, some of them have character flaws, but there's something about facing this problem that brings out or inspires people to become much more knowledgeable about life and about other people, and so that's why I think that the people in the program are smarter than the people who aren't, and that's why it's good to be in. I just think that, you know, people, I mean, I'm perfectly open about having been or being an alcoholic. You never not be an alcoholic. People, for instance, if you go to a party or something and they'll hide the bottle of alcohol, do they think you're going to jump on it and drink it?
Right.
Or do they think you're going to be inspired to start drinking because they have a bottle of alcohol? I mean, it's just, if somebody like me wants a drink, they're going to go to the liquor store and buy themselves whatever they want. It's just, I think addiction is pretty much misunderstood, and trying to escape or clamping down on your addiction and living in a way that you don't indulge it or whatever, or that you conquer it, that is also not generally understood by other people. But this is why it's so good to go to meetings, because there you are with everybody in the room knows perfectly well exactly what's going on with everybody else. And I mean, these are the people who know things.
Right. Well, I just want you to know I really appreciate your being public with your own addiction.
Well, I'm kind of proud of myself. I'm boasting.
Yeah. Last Saturday was my 20th anniversary of sobriety.
Oh, super. Yay. That's terrific.
And I don't regret a single moment of it.
Yep.
So anyway, we talked a lot about your relationship with people, but you're also well known for your work in research with animals, and it started with dogs. Why dogs?
Well, after we came back from Nigeria, I wanted to do, I mean, I didn't want to take my kids. I mean, my kids were of school age. They were no longer portable, little and portable. So I had to go to school, so I couldn't do the faraway trips that I had been doing. So I thought, you know, and also I've always wanted to write about animals, but animals weren't important enough to write about, kind of. So, but I was taking care of somebody else's dog, and he was a rather interesting dog. I had my own dogs. But this guy was so interesting, I thought, you know, why not see what he's doing and just see what he's doing? So I began to follow him. There were no leash laws back then, so dogs just roamed around. We were in the city, and he roamed around.
Right?
In Cambridge, Mass, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he would roam around, and I would follow him, and I learned so much. And then I wrote a book about him and the other dogs, and there were about seven or eight dogs in all, I guess, and about the hidden life of dogs, and it was a big bestseller. And then I wrote a book about cats, and I've, except for two novels, which were about Paleolithic people, I've really been writing about animals ever since, because that's what I want to write about. I mean, to me, that's animals are, with no disrespect, animals are more interesting than people, because we know about people, we don't know about animals.
Right. For those of you who are just joining us, I'm speaking now with Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, author of Dreaming of Lions, My Life in Wild Places, out on Chelsea Green. One thing I found really interesting about this book was that there's a whole chapter in it about writing.
Oh, that was fun to write, yeah.
And, you know, you include actually a lot of really practical advice for writers. I'd recommend anyone who's interested in the craft of writing to read the whole book and pay special attention to that chapter. But you talk a lot about the idea that this is in some ways kind of an unconventional memoir you've written. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I thought it was possibly unconventional. Well, I guess I kind of apologize for not writing it sequentially. It's by subject matter.
Right.
I mean, a piece on writing and a piece on whatever. Getting married and all that kind of stuff. But I had complaints from readers that it should have been sequential, but, you know, somebody's going to complain no matter what you write. What you do. And speaking of complaint, the dog book got a... Well, I would say the fan mail was 5 or 6 to 1, but I got an awful lot of criticism, and there were people who still don't like it because it suggests that dogs can find their own mates and that they can learn things from other dogs better than they learn from people. Well, that doesn't seem like a big strange thing, but we learn better from other people than we do from dogs, so... It's just one of those things.
I think I've met some people who've learned from dogs, but that's a
good
point.
Yes. Yeah, you can, but you got to be ready for it.
Right, and in the writing section, you actually talk a little bit about the idea of the way your use of pronouns regarding animals, which speaks to the esteem you hold.
Well, yes. I mean, there was a time when pets could be he and she. If it was a pet, that your dog could be she or he, your cat could be. But a wild animal or any insect, a bee or an ant that you're looking at is probably she, because it's the for many reasons. And so, but editors would scratch it out and make it. And you couldn't use who or whom, it had to be which or that. And I just will not do that. I will not do that. And a friend of mine wrote a wonderful, it's Cy Montgomery, she's a science writer.
Oh, I love her work.
And this her wonderful book about the octopus right now is going very well. And she was nominated for the National Book Award, so that was for that book. So, but in another book she wrote about a bird who laid an egg, and she called the bird she. Well, yeah. But the editor wanted to make the bird it. I mean, this is how extreme it got. But I just won't do that. They can't publish my stuff unless they conform to my wishes about pronouns.
That's right. Good. I'm sure they were very cooperative at Chelsea Green.
They would never do that. No, no.
Yeah,
they would never make you say it. No.
So in Dreaming of Lions, you tell your life story, but that story isn't over yet. What's next for you? We're winding up our time here, and I'd love to know what other adventures, if any, you have planned.
Well, I wanted to write one more Paleolithic novel, which I'm kind of started. I've got a terrific beginning, but I can't figure out what to do next. So when I do figure it out, I may write that. I also would like to write a book about writing, which I think would be fun, and a book about being old, which I think would be fun. Because it's very interesting. I mean, I'm 85, and it's very interesting to be old. I mean, all kinds of things are interesting about it. And I think, I mean, lots of people are old, and so they might like to read
right.
it.
Right. And do you have any travels planned, or?
Well, oddly enough, Cy Montgomery and some other people and I are going to Tanzania in June to see the wildebeest migration. We're going with Richard Estes, who is the most knowledgeable. He's the primary person about wildebeest. He knows, he's been studying them for many years. He knows more about them than anybody else in the world. So this is a huge opportunity, and we're going to go and do that. We'll be there about 3 weeks.
That sounds fantastic.
It'll be fun, yeah.
And I think it's the perfect thing to do when you're 85.
Oh, I do too.
Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, thank you so much for joining me today on Write the Book.
Oh, thank you very much.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Elizabeth Marshall Thomas. She's the author of Dreaming of Lions, My Life in the Wild Places, out now, published by Chelsea Green Publishing. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Calamity and Crow's Trading Post, twisting fresh tie-dyes for individuals, businesses, and organizations with standards like eyeballs, jerry bears, peace signs, and their signature tie-dyed mule. Custom artisan tie-dyes that rock. Contact Calamity and Crow's Trading Post on Facebook. And by the Farmhouse Tap and Grill, a farm-to-table gastropub serving award-winning burgers, innovative entrees, and world-class craft beers. For this week's writing exercise, take a cue from Elizabeth Marshall Thomas. Spend some time observing an animal in your backyard, in the wilderness, or even in your living room. Then write a paragraph or two about that animal's secret life. Thanks for listening to Write the Book. If you're interested in sharing the show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3 p.m. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and the Write the Book radio show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at the website of Write the Book host Shayla Shapiro, and that website is shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest, comments about the show, or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. The theme song for this episode of Write the Book is by Possum. You can find them on Facebook. I'm Gary Lee Miller, and you can find out more about me at GaryLeeMiller.com. I'm looking forward to more great book talk, and I hope you'll be here next time. This has been Write the Book, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont.
It's a hard story with a soft cover. Every heart is double-spaced for a bookmark. There's a bottle, so I don't lose my place. Well, it get too high, or it get too low. Stay out of late, or just don't go. Say what you want, I'll disagree. I could write a book,
he could write a book
about me. Yeah, I could write a book.
He could write a book.